Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see. Nothing to see. Nothing to see.
You are listening to Nothing to See Here, a program of spoken word experimental radio produced by David Clark. This episode is entitled Cosmic Listening.
Create an ambience of cosmic interplay, why don't we? Create an ambience of cosmic interplay, why don't we? Create an ambience of cosmic interplay, why don't we? Create an ambience of cosmic interplay, why don't we?
The basis of Hinduism is that the universe is constructed out of sound.
How do you understand that?
I don't. It's very complicated and I don't understand it. But like, that's where the word Om comes from, as it's right. Supposed to be like the cosmic, the sound of the cosmos. And there's a kind of meditation, it's called Nada Yoga, which is like an interesting... What do you call those false is it a false cognate? Like a word that sounds like it's the same as a word that means something different. It's not a homonym because it's a different language. Anyway, but it's a practice of meditation where you really deeply listen, and supposedly if you're like very, very skilled at this, you are able to like filter out all of the other noise and tap into the sound of the universe.
Ooh.
Gain that appreciation for nature, but it takes that amount of commitment of time. That's just a few moments, but it's like it takes you out of the your head and into this space where you I feel that I can actually ground myself in it. So I understand it's like, oh, can't you enjoy the concert without taking a picture of it? But people like to feel themselves embedded in a kind of like social context. Or can't you, I don't know, just smell the roses? Well, but maybe the roses can be appreciated in different ways. I totally agree with you. Like, people do immerse themselves in their stuff, but if you're annoyed about watercolors or David recording stuff, it's also like, that's a way to sometimes also gain appreciation. What's the story of this juice lady?
So, I was working at a strange time in my life at a juice bar. And it was like very, it was in this like very like intentionally cool part of Minneapolis. It was very just like gentrified and awful. But one of my coworkers was this yoga teacher named Patience. And Patience had only ever been a yoga teacher. That was her only job besides when she started this juice bar job. And she was talking with her boyfriend about opening up a yoga studio together. And one day she was telling me a little bit about it, and I asked her what the name of the studio was going to be. And she was like, this is, you know, like something I want to keep private and kind of like set that attention out into the world and then like let that happen. But it is in another language, and I asked her what the language was, and she went, oh, it's in Alien. And I was like, what? She was like, I don't know, what? Like, she was so genuinely startled by the idea that she had just said that it was in an alien language, or like what an alien language would be. Maybe. I mean, like, in the yoga world, like, you really have to, like, deeply, deeply reserve judgment, especially in your face when you talk to people, because you just don't know what's going to come out of their mouths. Like, I had someone tell me that limes were just unripe lemons, like, dead seriously, and I just had to be like, I don't know.
Wait, isn't that true? Is that what limes are? That's what you have in tequila? No.
But there was this other woman who I met once, all these people are, on the one hand, like, very lovely, open, wonderful people, but that openness can, like, go wrong. And she was, like, in Minneapolis after doing this, like, really intense yoga teacher training in Chicago with this yoga teacher whose whole, like, philosophy around asanas was that they came from ancient Egypt. And, like, all of those postures you see Egyptians do on the hieroglyphs are yoga postures, which is a really interesting idea. And also, like, I spent a lot of time thinking about, like, if that was healthy for your body to do those movements, because I don't think it is. First of all, I don't think it's possible, but if it were, I don't think it's
I do have a story about a stone. I have a friend in Brussels. She's absolutely fascinated by kind of engaging with these different religious movements, and sometimes quite fringe ones. And the film took place in Russia. And it was about a dolmen. It's a hut that is, or maybe like a box made out of these slabs of stone, right? And what people describe an experience of being out of their body, because they come into this stone hut or space, and then they sort of lie there or sit there or allow the space to take over. But what happens is it begins to resonate at a certain frequency. Cecile had interviewed scientists about this. She's interviewed people that have gone through the experience themselves. And every time, it is as if somebody's telling this a kind of dream or a dream sequence. And what's shown on screen is a kind of like almost dreamlike series of images. But then what happens is they utterly and completely convince you that they went on a different plane, on a kind of ethereal cosmic plane. The way that they felt, the way that their bodies felt, they lifted themselves up out of their physical presence and flied through some kind of cosmic energy to land back in, and that was their spiritual awakening. The story of the dolmen.
And big rocks, and there's a lot in Cornwall, and apparently they were used for like shamans to go inside of and then
Druids.
Go into a
stuff like that.
Yeah, but actual like shamans from all different sort of shamanic religions and Druids and people like that, they would go inside these big rocks and go into like dream states. So maybe it comes from that. I don't know. Or maybe no, well, I woke up in the middle of the night once to some little small gnome creatures walking into my room, and that's the story, basically. But there was about three of them in a row just walking into my room. They were just walking in, and they were just, like, acting like they owned the place. And they had, like, little pointy heads, maybe hats. Yeah, I don't know.
How long did you watch them?
Minutes or seconds, I actually don't know. It was in that weird dream state, so it was a hallucination, yeah, for sure, but like maybe it was also peering through.
What effect did that story have on you? Like, did you feel like you had to figure it out, or did it create some kind of doubt or belief in you that
I don't really know. I don't know, I was really obsessed with aliens and ghosts, all kinds of stuff like that. So whenever something like that happened, I would think about it a lot and probably cause more things like that to happen because I was so, like having imaginary fairies and stuff that was, like, real. So, or seeing imaginary fairies. So, yeah. I don't really know. I don't know.
Nice.
I've seen some other weird things as well. And I'm kind of in a sleepy state, so I guess that says a lot about
the cosmos.
But yeah.
I've experienced hallucinations. It was usually when I was super anxious. I once went to pee in a bush and I saw like a bunch of snakes and I freaked out so much. And it was in Newfoundland. I freaked out and I was like, oh my God, I'm crazy. I'm so crazy. I'm just the craziest person. I can never have children or lead a normal life, you know? But then I talked to myself, like through this kind of positive self-talk, I was like able to say to myself, dude, this was for me like a moment of spontaneous belief that then transitioned into disbelief through a kind of self-talk.
Now that I'm telling these stories now, because I haven't in a long time, I used to tell them with such like conviction, and it was like it was an alien visiting, and now it's like, okay, now it was a hallucination. So that transition of belief is already happening, I think. But it's something that I want to hold on to because I feel like it's quite important, for me personally anyway.
think this is like one of the first conversations we've had, was like about how, like, as a species, like, we just like obsessively make meaning. That's what we do. And like, it's a beautiful thing that we do, and sometimes it's a really horrible thing that we do, but like, that's just our impulse.
But taking from that, like, if we're trying to, again, we're inquiring about this term cosmic listening, which implies inherently that it's cosmic seems to be the thing we don't understand, right? So whatever this thing is that you experienced, and it's a real experience, whether it's a hallucination or not,
yes.
I'd also make the argument that consciousness itself is a hallucination,
yeah.
Right? You know, there's this implication of the term cosmic, which seems to lift us into kind of paying attention to the Gregory that isn't the anthropologist, that is trying to kind of aspire beyond the kind of confines of a profession, which has very kind of stark borders or whatever. So I think cosmic listening can be that thing that is aspirational, but also real, right? Like, maybe that's what you're trying to get at in the alien stories. It was neat having a father as an astronomer, because I think from a very early age, I understood that, you know, a lot of people went and did stuff, but my dad was trying to figure stuff out, right? And you know, there is nothing more mysterious than looking out into space and saying, what is all that? You know, like, is it infinite? Is it finite? Is there more of us out there? Is it? But for me, like, even to realize, like, something like, we thought the universe was our Milky Way. And then somebody discovered there's other entire galaxies that are like ours. And that was only in the last century. So we are constantly being pushed into like our understanding of the cosmic as soon as we get a grasp of it. Okay, it's really, really big, and we can compare it, and we can just blow the numbers up, and then we can make the numbers bigger, and then it's all pretty like, wow. But then like each and every time we do that, we can't understand like what the next step is gonna be.
In my last project, I interviewed a man from Moscow who was moving to Canada because he was a chemist, and he was going to work in a lab in Canada. And I asked him to choose an object that was really significant to him. He took the cross around his neck and showed it to me and described it to me. And I asked him, you know, this is kind of like the famous story about Niels Bohr, who had a horseshoe above his door, right? Like, yeah. But Niels, you are a skeptic, you're a man of science. So I asked him, but hey, how is this compatible with your sort of thirst for scientific knowledge? He goes, not just compatible, but completely congruent. Because in chemistry, he says, what we do is sometimes we synthesize chemicals that don't exist in nature. What we're doing is we are approaching the work of creation itself. We are doing God's work. In 2010, I made a film. I was in the midst of production on a film called The Theory of Happiness, later to be called The Theory of Happiness. And in the film, I became a participant in a radical Ukrainian sect trying to discover happiness through mathematical formulas. Now, that's a bit of an understatement, because what they were trying to do actually was to rank every human being on the pyramid of happiness. So does anyone here like drink or smoke or, yeah? Well, you're like 7% happy.
If you drink,
smoke, have sex. So this is their worldview. Here's the thing. It's easy to laugh at them, but here's the whole picture. They have founded this sect in the 80s, on the cusp of political transition in the Soviet Union, where a lot of people were looking for answers about what's happening in the world. And so they take as their like spiritual leaders, like Gorbachev and Lenin and Jesus and Gandhi. And it's a kind of like complete potpourri of every possible like spiritual tradition. They write political poetry. They rank every human being on this scale of happiness. And the goal is to basically find like or become the kind of progenitors for a new nation, for a new world. They're trying to create the city of the sun, Thomas Campanella style, and once this is achieved, they want to exit the mundane worldly plane. They want to enter into life eternal. What happens is some people don't agree with their version of happiness. And those people include the Russian and Ukrainian state prosecutors. So over the years, they have been charged with storing munitions, violating not through sexual, but through physical assault, violating minors. And there's a whole sort of series of possibly fabricated sort of narratives about them, like stockpiling grenades, guns, and this kind of thing. And so what they have been is persecuted and prosecuted by the state. And every single member of the sect has served time in jails and psychiatric hospitals. The leader of the sect, Yura Davidov, founded this thing in the 80s, and he recruited mostly young university women. The youngest member was recruited when she was 14. The person who is now a kind of de facto leader joined when she was 17. The sect was a kind of community. It was rife with abuse. It was violent. It was a very dangerous place. And ultimately, what that meant is anybody who ranked like lower on the scale of happiness was being disciplined by the higher ups who ranked higher on the scale of happiness. And I filmed this entire thing, and it was devastating from start to finish. I lived with them for 4 months. I slept on the floor for 4 or 5 hours a day in this sort of hut. We would work for 16 hours. Then, like, I was a shepherd sometimes. I would gather hay. When you are underslept, overtired in this structure, what happens is your sect superiors tell you, hey, you know, your real family, it doesn't love you. It's not, they're nobody. They don't know the kind of knowledge that we do.
They don't know how to enter the spiritual plane. We do. We are your true friends and we are your true family. When I sat with the leader of the sect, I wouldn't be allowed to interrupt her because that's not how happiness works. And sometimes she would speak for 4, sometimes 6, sometimes 8 hours. And he would just sit there and you would have to listen. The theory of happiness itself is the title of a book written by Yura Davidov. The book is called The Theory of Happiness. He wrote it while he spent 5 years in prison. It's written in poetry, the whole thing. It's a kind of instruction manual on how to, through math and through various sciences and knowledge, like the knowledge of Esperanto or nuclear physics, how to enter into eternal life. He projected that he would live until he was 180 years old. He lived until he was 55. He died of pneumonia. They didn't rush him to the hospital at the first signs of it because they thought that he would be cured by drinking these kind of potent fruit juices. My argument for the entire film, and through the entire film, was that, yeah, even a cynical, pseudo-intellectual like myself can absolutely and wholeheartedly become, like, succumb to the ideas of a sect. Because we're all looking for a sense of connection. We're all looking for a kind of social approval. And for me, it was even easier because I'm an anthropologist, right? Because I'm always trying to empathize with other people's realities. But I'm really afraid of a, and this did happen to me, of being able, because of a kind of anthropological worldview, to call out other people's bullshit.
You have been listening to Nothing to See Here, a program of experimental spoken word radio produced by David Clark. This episode was entitled Cosmic Listening. It featured the voices of Jaya Stenquist, Gregory Gann, Olivia Brelsford Massey, and David Clark. It was produced this week at the K.H. Messen International Artist Residency in Ulvik, Norway. It was recorded and mixed by David Clark, and the sound design was by David Clark. For more information on the film The Theory of Happiness by Gregory Gann, please go to gregorygann.com. Nothing to See Here is produced by David Clark.
Just do anything. Just do anything but art.
Can't we just get along without any art making?
Right.